Okay. That's Ajahn Gana, he says that. Okay. He's like this sweet, cuddly arahant. It's kind of interesting, isn't it? Anyway, okay, so let's kind of have a look at the questions. Lots of questions, okay. So this is the last evening, so we'll see what happens. Okay, good evening, Ajahn. Besides Ahimsaka, do you know any stories of naughty, dodgy characters with bad juju transforming their life and achieving favorable rebirth? if one is reborn in a lower realm or in a more difficult human life, how do they get back to advancing towards Nibbana? I'm not even sure who Ahimsaka is, to be honest with you. Is it one of the characters from the Jatakas or something? I'm not sure where that story comes from. It's not actually in the suttas. So. Was it? Was it Ahimsaka? All right. Okay. Okay, good. Yeah. So how does that work with Angulimala, the good rebirth? Anyway.
Not rebirth, I guess in that case he was
arahant. But
for those who didn't become arahants, I imagine they had to purify their moral conduct in order to kind of progress on the path somehow.
Yeah.
Kind of wondering how that gray karma could kind of still work favorably, or if some of the good karma could cancel out some of that naughty dodgy stuff.
Okay. So, So basically the idea in the suttas, and this is the story of Angulimala, is that regardless of how much bad karma you have done, you can still transform your life. Yeah, that's the kind of the thing. And this is what is so uplifting about that story. Yeah? And people often judge themselves and they criticize themselves really harshly for small little things. And here is a mass murderer. And he becomes an arahant. And that's actually, it's a very uplifting story because it does show you how it is possible from a Buddhist point of view to really change your entire life completely around. Yeah? And there's only a few things that you do that through which you will never be able to achieve anything. You know, the five kind of heinous crimes or whatever they're called, like killing your parents or whatever. If you haven't done that, you're right. So how many people have killed their parents? Not that many, I would guess. So it's a rare thing in the world for that to happen, right? So most people have the potential. And this comes from that very famous simile of the lump of salt. You know that simile of the lump of salt, presumably? You know that simile? Yeah, it's one of those famous similes in the suttas where they talk about how kamma is experienced. So if you have a small lump of salt, and you put it in a glass of water. I put it into the tea that you made for me. That made the tea undrinkable, right? Because a small lump of salt makes a glass of water really undrinkable. So here the salt signifies the bad karma you have done, and the water signifies the good karma you have done. And the taste is very bitter. That signifies the experience or the result of that karma. But if you have exactly the same amount of bad karma, but you put it in a large body of water, in the suttas, I think they said the river Ganges or something like that, I mean, really enormous body of water, you won't even taste it. I mean, if you taste it, it's kind of so tiny, it's as if it wasn't there anymore. And so that's the large amount of good karma you have made compared to the same amount of bad karma, right? So all you have to do is you have to dilute your bad karma. And as you dilute it, then that karma doesn't really have much effect anymore. And this is kind of the idea behind this, yeah? So this is kind of how Angulimala overcomes his bad karma by just doing something really powerful. And he may also have had good, you know, characters from, or good characteristics from a past life, maybe many things kind of coming together. That's kind of what's happening there, I think. Yeah? So that's kind of nice, isn't it? There's always hope for everyone, yeah? That's kind of really, really wonderful. And we should never write anyone off. We should never kind of say, you're a hopeless case, sorry, you can't come to BCBS, you're kind of, you're a no-hoper. There's no such thing as a no-hoper in Buddhism. And even if you killed your parents, okay, you go to hell for a while, but then when you come back, maybe you can continue on the path. Yeah? So, are you okay with that? Exactly.
Yeah. Did you say there was four other harness things besides killing your parents? I want to make sure I didn't do any of those too.
Killing your parents is two of them, mum and dad. Don't kill any arahants, yeah? I don't know if you, how you, that's kind of hard. They're hard to come by anyways, it's kind of hard. It's difficult to kill arahants. Don't shed the Buddha's blood. Now you're pretty safe from that one. Shed the blood of a Buddha.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's pretty hard to do these days. And don't create a schism in the Sangha. That's impossible for a layperson to do. Only monks can create schism in the Sangha. So yeah, that one is, you can, you're right. You're safe. So it's pretty hard to do these things, right? You have to be pretty, pretty kind of, yeah. Anyway, so good. Let's go on to the next one. What is your and the rest of the BSWA relationship with the Dhammayut order? Okay, I ask because of the bhikkhu controversy, unfortunately. Okay, how hard is it to switch monastic lineages if you join, for example, Shwegin, that's a Burmese, to a Thai forest monastic community here? Relationship with the Dhammayut order. Well, this is actually a split between the Mahanikaya and Dhammayut, the two kind of monastic orders in Thailand. And we belong to the Mahanikaya anyway, initially. So we never really had much to do with the Dhammayuts. So that doesn't make much difference whether, you know, that has nothing to do with the Bhikkhuni ordination as such, because that split was already there. So our split is more with to do with the Wat Phapong Sangha, which is the Sangha of Ajahn Chah in Thailand. Yeah, because they are the ones who didn't like the Bhikkhuni ordination. So that's kind of where the split is. But to be honest, it doesn't matter. It's kind of irrelevant, right? It is irrelevant because sometimes you have a difference of opinion and then there's a split, and that's kind of how life often is, isn't it? And that's okay. Sometimes you have different views of how things should be done, different views of Dhamma, different views of Vinaya, different views about bhikkhunis or whatever, and then you go different directions. Why not? And so I'm not really concerned about that split. And I don't think there is necessary to really... I mean, you reconcile on the level of forgiveness and on the level of compassion and kindness. You reconcile on that level. But whether it really is necessary to kind of join and be part of the same group, I don't think such groups are appropriate anyway in Buddhism. We shouldn't kind of... all this forming of subgroups doesn't seem to make any sense anyway. So, to be honest, it's kind of irrelevant. Anyway... I don't see any big issues. I think lay people are sometimes more concerned about the split than monastics. I think monastics, we have kind of moved on already. So how can you switch monastic lineages, for example, from the Burmese Shwegin order to a Thai forest monastic community? It probably depends a bit on the community. At Bodhinyana Monastery, we are very open, because the idea from the point of view of the Vinaya is that any good monastic... should be allowed in to your community. Yeah, if you're a good monastic, that is what decides whether you should be allowed in or not. Not whether there is some artificial segmentation within the Sangha. Because those segmentations didn't exist at the time of the Buddha. They are kind of irrelevant. That's not what the Dhamma is about. So we would, if someone is a Mahayana monk, but they practice well, they keep the precepts, we would invite them into the Sangha in our monastery here. Because that seems like the right thing to do. Good monastics are good monastics regardless. But there are other monasteries or other places that have a more kind of strict idea of what is acceptable or not. I guess they have to do what they have to do. What can you... just people do different things. Okay with that reply? I don't no idea who asked that question. Okay, good. How do you think about the mental powers discussed in the suttas? Even if I were able to believe in rebirth based on confidence in the teachings and evidence, it is harder to find evidence and confidence in the mental powers, magical type mental powers, like flying through the air, sinking into the ground. It would be pretty impressive if you saw that, wouldn't it? It would be kind of an eye-opener at least. These mental powers, I would say, don't worry about them, because they are not really relevant for the path as such. They don't really have a part on the path. They may be kind of you may call them outcomes of the practice that may happen because you happen to incline your mind in that direction, but they're not important on the path. They're kind of irrelevant for whether, you know, you become an arahant or you have a jhanas or whatever. That's got nothing to do with that. So they're kind of, okay, maybe they exist, maybe they don't. I think they exist, but, you know, if you don't think they exist, fine. It's not a problem at all as far as the path is concerned. To me, it is more like, you know, once you start to believe in the power of the mind, and you believe that the mind is primary, and the mind kind of comes before material phenomena, then suddenly things become possible, right? That otherwise you would never really, might never believe otherwise, can be done. And suddenly the idea of walking on water, yeah, that's kind of cool, walking on water, and not the frozen lakes, but the kind of the real water, that maybe that's possible. Maybe Jesus did walk on water, right? Maybe he had some psychic powers. May have nothing to do with it. It wasn't a miracle, it was just kind of a natural power of the mind, maybe. Don't know. Or maybe he read the suttas because and then kind of made up the story because the suttas were available in that part of the Middle East. Yeah, in at that time, there were Buddhist monks around in Alexandria, which is part of the kind of larger Hellenic Greek kind of circle down there, and there were Buddhist monastics there, so maybe they had read that story here, and maybe they kind of somehow things got confused. There are some people who have been arguing this particular point, that story original is a Buddhist story here, Jesus walking on water. Who knows what's actually going on here? So, anyway, it's really up to you whether you want to believe in those things. But what really matters is the three tevijas, the three things, the recollection of past life, the idea of rebirth depending on kamma, and the insight into non-self and the awakening experience. Those three matter. The other three higher psychic powers are not so important. And whether you believe in them or not is not matter that much. All right, maybe, maybe not, okay, good enough. it comes to mind that there was someone who asked about Pali studies. I got a note, I'm not sure who that person is. They had a name on it. Oh, that's you, oh, okay, all right, okay. Okay, very good. Do you want to talk to me personally about that? Is that a good idea?
Sure.
Yeah? After lunch tomorrow, is that convenient for you? Or?
Yeah.
Okay, so see you after lunch tomorrow. I can talk about that and whatever you want to ask about, because it's a bit specialized field maybe.
Sure.
Yeah. Great. Okay. Okay. Why do Buddha statues have hair when the historical Buddha had a shaved head? That is fascinating, isn't it? So one of the reasons is that when you have icons, and you have to somehow distinguish the Buddha from other monks. So how do you distinguish the Buddha from other monks? Now, the one way to do that is to have what is called the Dvatingsa Mahapurisa Lakkhana, the 32 marks of a great person, a great man. Yeah, and these are talked about in the suttas. And so you use some of those 32 marks then to make it clear that we're talking about the Buddha in this particular case. Yeah, that's how it works. So one of the famous marks of the Buddha is that his hair, each hair grows in a single, it's a very strange thing, this 30. Don't take it too seriously, please. But this is kind of what it says. So each hair grows from one, it's only one, one follicle, one kind of hair to each pore, only one at a time. And each hair curls clockwise in a certain direction, Each hair turns clockwise in a direction. So if you look at the hair on the Buddha, everyone turns in a certain direction, It looks like it's curling up, that's what it looks like, And that comes from that idea, because it is the Mahapurisa Lakkhana, the signs of a great man, right? That's where it comes from. And that's how you recognize the Buddha, because nobody else has that sign. That's why it is used to mark the Buddha, even though the Buddha actually had a shaven head. Another thing you will see on the Buddha is the Ushnisha. It's like a protrusion on the top of the head, right? Very common, you see that in Buddha statues. Actually, all Buddha statues are supposed to have that. That's how you recognize the Buddha. Ushnisha is another of these 32 marks of a great man. Another one is what is called the Unna. Unna is the mark. You have seen the mark between the eyebrows? Have you seen that? That is not one of those marks that Indian women often use. Yeah, the henna mark, which they use kind of as a beauty mark or whatever. It is not that. It is actually the eyebrow is supposed, the Buddha is supposed to have one eyebrow that goes all the way across. So that is the mark, which marks the middle of that. So those are the three ways you can recognize a Buddha statue. That is how you know it is a Buddha statue, not some other monk or nun or whatever. And that's pretty much it. Then you have the long earlobes. The long earlobes are not one of the 32 marks, yeah? So they are just an additional thing that is used. No one knows exactly why the Buddha has long earlobes, but it could be that at that time the royalty would, or not really royalty, but the higher caste were using jewelry. So maybe the jewelry kind of pulled down your earlobe when you got long earlobes. Don't know. It's uncertain. So but that's kind of how the Buddha statue is, how you recognize the Buddha. So what about these 32 marks of a great man? What are they about? And they seem to be a ancient Brahmanical idea, that the ancient Brahmanical texts, they had ideas about what the perfect human being is supposed to look like. And so you read those 32 marks and you wonder what on earth this has to do with the perfect human being. But anyway, that's what they had. And so then at some point in history, the Buddhist would have taken this on board, right? If this is what the perfect man, okay, the Buddha is perfect, he must have those marks, yeah? Obvious, it's kind of clear, obvious logic. But the point, of course, is that, you know, if you want to kind of sell this to the Brahmins or to the prevailing culture at the time, you have to kind of bring in some of these ideas that the existing culture had. This is how things often happen in religious traditions or whatever. So very occasionally they're talked about in the suttas. They are not important at all. They are a complete side issue, a sidetrack from anything important, and they're only useful in recognizing Buddha statues. That's the only thing they're useful for. If you look at those 32 marks and the Buddha really had those, he would have been a freak. And that kind of defeats the purpose, in my opinion. And he's never, you know, when in the suttas, people just see the Buddha as any other human being. Yeah, they can't distinguish the Buddha from Mahakasapa. They can't distinguish one monk from another one. So obviously, he looked quite normal. He didn't look kind of really weird or anything. Yeah. anyway, so that's the story for that one. Dear Ajahn, as a child, I had a vivid traumatic recollections of my own death. Wow, that's interesting. And it wasn't until this week that I've begun to accept the idea of rebirth and that these memories may be from the past life. Excellent, that's wonderful. Do you hear many stories of people remembering past lives? How can we use these stories to help strengthen right view? That's really interesting, and thank you for mentioning this. It's because I always find these things very fascinating when you start talking about these things. So many people have these kind of experiences, right? It's really fascinating here. Do I hear many stories of people remembering past lives? Well, I do, but sometimes it varies a lot to what extent these things are reliable, right? I have heard stories of children who have recollections of various kind of things, which point in that direction. Sometimes you hear people having meditation experiences and have like pictures arising in the meditation that look like they may have been a past life. Very hard to know. If it's just a picture in your mind, an image that arises, very difficult to know whether it's a past life or just something happening here. But if it is a young child, as in your case, that is very interesting here. Because young children have very little life experience, and very often they're very kind of open and straightforward, right? And so that is, to me, is a sign that this may very well be authentic as far as I look at these things. That's good. And I always take these stories very seriously when I hear them. Can we use these stories to help strengthen right view? Absolutely, you can use those stories. Just hearing the stories here, the people have had here, trying to understand your own story better, reading, some of the books that talk about these kind of things. I was personally very touched by reading that. That's why I mentioned this book before, the story, the book called After by Bruce Grayson, which talks about near-death experience. It was a very touching read, actually, seeing people being transformed by these experiences that they have. It was very powerful, and it kind of adds so much to the kind of more dry setting out of the rebirth kind of paradigm in the suttas. It makes it really come alive in a very good way. So yes, absolutely, this has to do with right view. So reflect on them, start to maybe see if you can have some more clarity about what happened at that time, and then read other people's stories, and then start to build up an understanding of what is going on. And as you build up an understanding, you combine it with the suttas, you combine it with everything, things start to fall into place, and it becomes like something more firm. All right. Ajahn Brahmali, how does one develop the quality of kindness and a kind disposition towards all people, especially when one doesn't feel like being kind? you don't have to be kind towards everyone, but at the very least, you shouldn't be bad towards anyone, right? It really comes from the ideas that we were talking about earlier on today, the idea of learning to see people in a new way. First of all, focusing on the good qualities. When you see someone's good qualities, it's like you want to be kind, right? Because that's what it means to have a friend. Having a friend means seeing someone's good qualities. Is it someone you enjoy being around? Is someone who you have a good time with or whatever? So that is the first part, seeing the good qualities, rejoicing in people's kindness. Sometimes people may just do one act of kindness, and it's wonderful. Yeah, you're just rejoicing in that. Wow, thank you so much for being kind to me. Yeah, for bringing the chocolate or whatever it is. That's wonderful. So this is one way. The other way is, remember, it's this very powerful idea that people are not in charge of themselves, that they are running on programs, that they are more like robots, really. This is a very powerful thing, because then compassion becomes possible. Even for people who you don't really feel want to be kind with, once compassion arises, you actually start to want to be kind. You want to give them a pat on the back, at least. Maybe there's nothing you can say, because maybe you can't change their views about the world, but you know that they are in trouble. You know that, like everyone else in this world, they are in trouble. Their suffering is a problem. They're creating more suffering for themselves and for others at the same time. Okay, listen, I have compassion for you. You're all right. I know life is not easy. Whatever you can do in those difficult situations, but understanding other people is such a powerful tool. There's a French saying which goes something like, tout comprendre, c'est tout pardonner. Tout comprendre, to understand everything. Comprehend, right? Tout comprendre, tout pardonner. Pardonner is to pardon. So to understand all is to forgive all. When you really understand where someone is coming from, their conditioning, their background, their history, how can you not understand them? You would do exactly the same thing if you were in their boots. So simple things. These are very simple ways of looking at the world, but also very powerful. So make use of them. Okay. Bhante Ajahn, if I have good karma, I may be reborn as a deva or a human, but what if I wish to be reborn as a tiny bird? Or a tree, or a loving dog? Do I have a choice in what realm I want to be reborn? So I would... sometimes you may have those wishes. I would not recommend those wishes, to be honest with you, because sometimes we romanticize maybe these kind of things. We think that being a tiny bird looks nice, you can fly around and have fun and enjoy yourself. Or being a loving dog who gets fed by the master. Sometimes you don't get fed, sometimes you get kicked by the master. That's the problem with being a dog. You are really kind of vulnerable. So I would recommend you to look at nature very carefully before you have these kind of wishes, because nature is a very brutal place. really, really brutal. This is what I was saying the other day. I look at the kangaroos in the monastery in Perth. Lots of kangaroos around. Sometimes I give them a bit of food when I have a bit of extra and all of these kind of things. And initially you think they're cute, but actually after a while they're not all that cute. They are greedy, they are violent, they are all kind of things. And sometimes they are cute actually, true, they do cute things as well. But they do a lot of things that are not the exact anti-cute. Yeah, this is kind of the, this is one of the problems. So, and the more you look at nature, the more you see of this brutality in nature, how everyone is fighting with each other, how there's no compassion or understanding here, how you just kind of steal from each other, and they do all of these kind of things. So I wouldn't recommend that sort of wish. Get reborn somewhere where you can understand the Dhamma. You can't understand the Dhamma if you're a tiny bird. Yeah, you don't have the faculties if you try to tell your dog about dependent origination. There's nothing that's going to happen, right? It's going to go in one ear. It's not even going to go in one ear, actually. It probably stops even before there. So there is no... And that's the problem of being an animal. There's a very difficult situation to be in. So become a human being at the very least. I really recommend that. Don't go for anything lower than a human being. Yeah. Okay. That was your question. Okay. Good. So, but the underlying question is still interesting, right? That's the question about, can you guide your rebirth? Can you decide where you get reborn? And that's kind of an interesting one. And the answer to that is that you can kind of know where you will get reborn by looking at your mind. Yeah, you come to meditation in a place like this and you can see where your mind is leaning. Yeah? And by understanding where your mind is leaning, that inclination of the mind is also the tendency of the mind, is where the mind will tend to get reborn. So what kind of mind have you got, right? If you feel like a dog, well then, you're going to get reborn. There's a nice sutta about that called the Dog Duty Ascetic, the Kukravattika Sutta. And this is this fellow, this kind of ascetic in ancient India, he's practicing the dog life, yeah? You know that one? And he goes around on all fours and he eats from the ground and he curls up at night and sleeps at night. And then he goes to the Buddha, and he goes to the Buddha with his friend. His friend is a ox duty ascetic, right? So the ox duty and the kind of dog duty, that they go together to the Buddha. And they said to the Buddha, well, Master, please let us know, what kind of fruit can we expect from this harsh ascetic life? And the Buddha says, don't ask that question. Don't ask that question. He said, please, we want to know it. But I said, don't ask that question. And eventually, they kind of persuade the Buddha to answer. And the Buddha says, well, if your dog duty ascetic practice succeeds, you get reborn as a dog. And if it doesn't succeed, you get reborn in hell. And so they start crying, right? No, oh, they start crying. And they were, I told you not to ask that question, yeah, because it's really going to be very, very harsh on you. And of course, then they can, that gives them opportunity to change their habits, and then they can come out of that. Yeah. But the point there is, if you really do develop the idea, the mind of a dog, you become a dog, because you pretty much are a dog already, so you just carry on being a dog in your next life. Same way, if you practice deep samadhi like the jhana states, if you have those available to you in this life, when you die, the mind goes automatically there, because that is the happiness it knows, and you get reborn accordingly. So this gives you an idea of, you can know, have some idea where you get going to get reborn. Yeah, where is your mind? If you think about sensual pleasures all the time, okay, probably reborn as a human, right? If the sensual pleasures get a little bit less, but maybe a bit more refined or more inclining towards peace, okay, maybe then you are heading towards some Devaloka, perhaps. This is kind of how you can know where you get reborn. Can you direct your mind? I wouldn't recommend it. Because I think you're going to mess up the whole dying experience. We don't know how to do that anyway. This is very, to my mind, is a very bad idea. Dying is already difficult enough as it is. And the best way to die is just to be at peace. Yeah, there are some very dangerous ideas in Buddhism. One of those dangerous ideas is the idea that the death moment is very important. You have to make your mind kind of pure and ready at the death moment. But it's kind of very stressful. Yeah, you are dying. And people around say, watch your mind, don't die, think the right thing. Can you panic on your deathbed? Right? It's not a good way of dying, yeah? So when you die, you should relax, you should be at ease, you shouldn't have to worry about your last mind state. That's the last thing you want to do, yeah? And this whole idea of the last mind state being important, it comes from certain ideas that came much later in Buddhism, which are developments in the Abhidhamma, and how the death moment is immediately followed by the rebirth moment. There's no gap in between. And that means that, of course, then, in that case, you can see why it matters. But actually, Buddhism seems to be more about that there's an intermediate existence after you die, before you are reborn. Oh yeah. Okay. So hope I don't die before I leave the US. No, I'll be all right. I'm just joking.
So like in hospice, they put people on morphine.
Yeah.
Pretty much put someone into a coma, and I would imagine it's quite cloudy from being drugged up. So is that, where does that fit into the idea of death and immortality?
Yeah. Yeah, so I'll get to that as well. So I'll bring all of these things, all of these threads together here. And so so because there is this idea of intermediate state, and it seems to be in the suttas, and when you read about near-death experiences, you see people seem to have intermediate experiences. Yeah, they're neither in this life, they kind of left their body, but they haven't really entered the next life either. And that is where the karma kind of sorts itself out, yeah, and then you get reborn accordingly, which means you don't have to panic on your deathbed. You can actually relax, you can let go, enjoy the journey. And for good people, dying is a very pleasant thing, yeah, because you are old, your body is ill, you're letting go of something very painful and bad, and you're getting a release from that. Think, wow, this is really nice. Yeah, gee, why was I afraid of dying? This is just really wonderful, yeah. And that is if you die well, yeah, if you die being able to let go. And of course, that is much easier if you do a lot of death contemplations. Yeah. So don't try to be reborn anywhere on the deathbed. I think that is really a bad idea. Don't worry about having your mind in the right space. Don't try to, think, where should I get reborn? And try to direct your mind. You're going to mess it up probably, right? This is the reality. We don't know how to do these things. It's so uncertain how these things work. So what about morphine or drugs on the deathbed? And I think it is no problem. And the reason I think so is because when you come very close to your death, and this is the idea of what they call terminal lucidity sometimes in geriatric care. And this is the thing which apparently happens to many very old people who have been had Alzheimer's for 10 or 20 years, completely out of it, haven't recognized anyone. And suddenly, the last 10 minutes of their life, they start recognizing people. Have you seen that? Because if you were in hospice, yeah. And that's kind of weird, right? And it doesn't make very good sense from a kind of ordinary medical point of view. But from a Buddhist point of view, it makes really good sense, because at this point, your mind is starting to release from the body. So the deceased brain doesn't have a hold over the mind in the same way as it had before. And so your mind is released from that hold, physical hold of the brain, and then it kind of regains its memories and regains its clarity. Same thing happens with morphine, yeah? As you start to leave the body, those physical things that limit the mind while in the brain, you are released from that. So your mindfulness just comes back again, bang, straight away. And then that mindfulness is then what you use to go through the rebirth process, yeah? It's no issue. So in fact, I would recommend morphine, because if you don't use some kind of drug to help you deal with the pain, actually, it's very unpleasant. The whole experience becomes very unpleasant. You might get angry and upset and have desires and all kinds of things because of that. So I think it's actually much better to use those drugs than not to use them. That's my take on that. All right. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, would you be so kind as to expand on the theme of Buddhism and the will? Thanks for your answer. Buddhism and free will. Yes, really what I was talking about earlier on today, Did I answer the question satisfactorily at that point? Yeah, you were happy with that? Okay. So maybe I'll leave it at that. So the idea for me of freedom of will is actually having real choices. Most people don't have real choices because they are limited by the defilements. Once you remove the defilements and delusion, you actually open up real choices because you start to understand where happiness is. If you don't even know where happiness is to be found, what's the point of having free will? Yeah, it's like what they say in the American Constitution, the pursuit, liberty, what is it? Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, something like that, yeah? So, but what's the point of being having the liberty to pursue happiness if you don't know where happiness is? This is the kind of the limitation of that constitution, right? It's a nice sentiment, I have to admit, it's a very nice sentiment. But it, you know, from a Buddhist point of view, it doesn't really have the full, you know, full understanding there. Okay, so I will leave it at that. Could you give an example of clinging to Vedana? Is that identifying with a thing that gives rise to good feelings? Identify with a gender, for example. Clinging to Vedana, it just means that you, or grasping or attaching to Vedana, it just means that you have a nice feeling and it feels, and you're holding on to it. And when you grieve when it goes, yeah, or you're sad when it goes, that means you have clung to that feeling because you're sad when it disappears. So let's say that you are in a relationship, yeah, and that relationship gives rise to some nice feelings and then they leave you. That's dukkha. That's part of that is clinging to Vedana. Huh? It's as simple as that, really. Huh? This feeling, everything has feelings. Feelings is one of the most important things that we cling to all the time. Yeah, and so that is really what it means. Is that identifying with a thing that gives rise to good feelings? Yes, yeah. So you cling to those things that are the cause of the feeling, yeah? So in a relationship, you cling to your partner or whatever, yeah? Because you think that they are the cause of the feeling, yeah? Actually, it's the chemistry in your brain, but actually that's a different thing, yeah? So maybe just get some electrodes implanted in your brain and zap your brain and you get the same feelings, you're in business. Okay, so clinging to feeling is a very... very much what this is about. Usually we only cling if there are good feelings. Yeah, we only grasp when there are good feelings. That's a very fundamental part of this whole process of clinging, because it's feelings that give life meaning. Without feelings, without things being kind of positive for us or negative or whatever, things wouldn't have any meaning for us. Yeah, it is that very fact that they give positive and negative feelings that makes them meaningful. If you're in this room and you look at this room and it doesn't give rise to any kind of feeling whatsoever, you wouldn't be able to tell whether it's a nice room or a good room or anything. It would be completely meaningless to you. Everything in the world would be meaningless if there's no feelings. Life, you would just lie in your bed all day, do nothing, because nothing would have any purpose. So feeling is one of those very critical factors on the path. And that is why it is found in the middle of dependent origination. Yeah, Vedana Paccaya Tanha. Feeling is the cause for craving. Yeah. Because it is one of these critical elements that drives the whole process of dependent origination. It's right there in the middle of dependent origination. All right. So, please feel free to ask follow-up questions if you don't feel I have understood your question properly or whatever. So, dear Ajahn, can you please tell us a bit more about how you become convinced, gain confidence in the idea of rebirth? I want to have faith, but my conditioning makes me skeptical. Thank you. Yeah. It's just a natural process. You know, if you are skeptical, don't worry about it. Don't try to convince yourself that this is true. Just keep on investigating. Yeah. Try to have a reasonably open mind. Don't close it off completely. Because if you close it off completely, to me that's silly. There are so many things in this world that are possible. The world is a strange place. And once we accept that the world is a strange place, it's good to be open to all kind of phenomena. So be open, at least try to be open. And then start to investigate, read a bit in the suttas, maybe read some books about near-death experiences, see what is going on, and see if it changes your attitude. And don't force it. Let things come naturally. And if you then eventually decide to reject rebirth, so be it. We just have to follow our heart. We can't force ourselves to believe in things we can't believe in. That's really important. Otherwise, it's kind of madness. But that is how it happened with me. And I think maybe... I probably had a predilection towards believing these things from the outset. It was never very difficult for me to believe in these things.
Some more hot water in there for you?
Okay, why not? I will definitely accept that kind gesture. Yeah. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. So, and then see how things happen. Yeah, see how things develop as you keep on reading about it. And for me, it wasn't very difficult, even though I was basically an atheist before I became a monk, or agnostic atheist, whatever, somewhere in that camp. Still, to me, the idea wasn't very weird. I don't consider it to be religious to believe in rebirth. I think rebirth, either it's true or it's not true, and that's like anything within science. Yeah, it's true or it's not true. It's not about whether... It's not something you hold on to, you grasp onto as a dogma in that sense. And if science tells you there's no rebirth, well, then there is no rebirth. We can't hold on to things that are false. That is kind of crazy. So keep on looking, see what happens. That's what I recommend. Okay, why do some nuns use the title Ajahn instead of Aya? Because Ajahn just means teacher, and the tradition in many countries is that once you become a teacher, once you have been a monastic for roughly 10 years, that's when you become a teacher. If you look at the Pali canon, the Vinaya, the kind of the monastic rules and how it is used there, the nuns are often called Acharini. And monks are called Acharya, and the nuns are called Acharini, and both mean teacher, and it's basically the same word. So there's no reason why nuns can't be called Ajahn. Yeah, teacher, that's all it means. Whereas Aya is more a generic term used for nuns. So Aya is actually a beautiful word. It is derived from the word Arya. Arya means noble. So when you say Aya to a nun, you're actually saying the noble one, right? That's what you're saying. So it's actually a very nice title for somebody. So Aya is used usually for any nun, regardless of their age, regardless how long they have been a monastic. And so it's a more general term. That could be one of the reasons why there is that difference. Yay! Wonderful. Sadhu, sadhu. Let's see if this works, see what happens now. Okay, see the effect. Okay, so I hope that is okay with you. Go on to the next one. Venerable Ajahn Brahmali. Okay, this is getting very formal, but but I appreciate your kind way of putting it. How can I find out about the upcoming residential retreats held at the Buddhist Society of Western Australia? Thank you. You have to go to the website. And on the website, you find a tab for Jhana Grove. Jhana Grove is the retreat center. Jhana Grove, yeah? And that was named because Ajahn Brahm was into jhana practice. Some of the lay people said, we've got to call it Jhana Grove. And thus it became Jhana Grove. So go there, and there you will find the various retreats. They are tabulated, and then there is usually a time when it opens up for booking, yeah? Usually about 6 weeks or something before the actual start of the retreat. And then if you want to book a place, you have to be on your computer. And the second the booking commences, you had to have someone who knows how to kind of fill in these sheets with some kind of software or something, get filled in, bang, straight away. And then you kind of can send it off, because it's incredibly hard to get onto those retreats. I mean, really, really hard. Ajahn Brahm retreats get snapped up in like 2 minutes. My retreats maybe takes 4 minutes, I'm not sure. But it's... It's like really short. So you have to be on the ball. If you are over a certain age, get one younger family member to do it for you, because you won't be fast enough on that computer. Yeah. You've got to be under 30 to be able to get onto those retreats. Otherwise, you're going to be too slow. Your reflexes are too slow already. Yeah. So that's how you get onto those retreats. No. You have to be a member, right? You have to be a full member of the Buddhist Society, which means that you have to take the five precepts and that sort of thing. Yeah, fill in the form. The form is available online. Are you a member of the BSWA? Really? Wow. Have you been down there before? No, you haven't. Okay.
I've never been fast enough.
Never been fast enough yet. Okay. Okay. Cool. Okay.
But you have to be a member for a period before
you can apply. Yeah. Because otherwise people become member just the day before, yeah, so just kind of, okay, and then as soon as they kind of finish, they kind of, they cancel again, and they kind of, that happens sometimes, yeah.
Can I say something?
Please, yeah, please, yeah, Shirley.
You can apply even if you're not member. The thing is, the members, they have priority. Like Ajahn said, you know, the first couple of hours, it's all gone.
Yeah. Yeah. Shirley has been down to our place on several occasions, so she knows I'm honestly quite well. Yeah, yeah. So you can share your secrets, Shirley, with everyone. Then. So that's good. But it's nice to be a member anyway, because if you're a member, you're also supporting the Buddha side a little bit. So it's a nice thing to do, I reckon. So yeah. All right. Is there an alternative word for spirituality or spiritual path? Does inner path work? Or what is the Pali equivalent? The Pali equivalent, the usual word in the suttas, is called like brahmacharya. And brahmacharya literally means the Brahma conduct, the conduct of Brahma. In other words, the conduct of the high divine beings, like the conduct of the four Brahma-viharas, of metta, karuna, those things. Very elevated. So that's what it really means in Pali language. And it implies celibacy or that sort of thing. Yeah. So how do you say that in English? Don't know how to say it in English. Spiritual path, you can really make up whatever word you like. Yeah, it's up to you. If you have a preferred word, you can use that. No one else may understand what you're talking about, but, you know, that is... I think spiritual path, the reason we often use that is because it's kind of a standard word used in English to talk about people who develop their minds. Yeah, that's how I understand spiritual path in a very general sense. Someone who is interested in developing their inner qualities. That's kind of how I think about spiritual path. How do I translate brahmacharya? I can't remember now. Maybe I use spiritual path? I can't. Something like that. Yes, it doesn't really matter as long as you feel comfortable with the word. I don't feel comfortable with the word religion for Buddhism. I think because I still consider myself a bit of an atheist, actually. I'm an atheist Buddhist. And because, you know, the idea of a creator God doesn't make any sense to me. So I kind of gave up that idea a very, very long time ago. And so if I call Buddhism a religion, I feel it's a bit like I'm going back into that those things again. So what is Buddhism? Well, to me, it is a psychology. It is certainly not a philosophy. Philosophy means you work things out according to some kind of grand scheme. It's not really about that at all. But it is a psychology because it's all about developing your mind, right? It's about changing your outlook by calming yourself down. It's all about mental things, really, mental development. Well, what is that? Well, it's psychology here. Rebecca, what do you say? You are a psychiatrist, or
I'm focused more on the heart. But yeah. As long as the mind is the servant of the heart, it's fine.
Yeah, when I say mind, I really mean the heart. I don't mean a distinction there, right?
All right, then you're with it.
You're with it. I'm with it. Okay, good.
People to deepen into their hearts. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Sure.
So do you think of Buddhism as a kind of psychology then, or
if we're defining, then than when I try to teach people is kind of deep into their hearts. I don't know how else to put it.
Yeah, okay.
If you want to call that a psychology, that's fine.
Yeah, okay. Good.
It's good, anyway.
Yeah, it's good. It's good. Remember, that's the easiest way.
People learn that is the heart. Yeah. It's a good thing.
It's not a psychologist. It's not a philosophy. It's not. It's just good. Yeah. That's kind of the fourth category. Yeah. I think we can agree on that one. Yeah. Okay. Good. So let's go on to the next one. Okay. As you mentioned, in dealing with pain during meditation, continued practice makes it easier. Can you speak about how to work with chronic pain in multiple areas of the body while sitting here, to enable one to continue with practice, ultimately making it easier to manage into long-term practice, i.e. what can one do in the sit when various areas are painful? How does one work with this? Yeah, it is not easy. It is having chronic pain is certainly a challenge. So first of all, I would say make sure use medication. There's nothing wrong with using medication as long as it doesn't make the mind too clouded. So if that is helpful, use that. Another thing is posture. Make sure you find the posture that is most suitable. I know that some people who have chronic pain, they can lie down and they can use the lying down posture. Is often more helpful for them because lying down is maybe the most relaxed posture in many ways. So don't be afraid of experimenting with different kinds of postures. And lying down is actually perfectly fine. We had Ajahn Gandaha, who I mentioned before. He came to visit Poninana Monastery a long time ago. And one of the monks who was there at the time, he asked Ajahn Gandaha, well, how do you meditate? He says, I lie down. And he said, well, and what do you do? And so what do you do when you lie down? Oh, no, I don't do anything when I lie down. Well, if you don't do anything, don't you fall asleep? No, that would be doing something here. That's a nice story, isn't it? So if you are really natural about lying down, you're just clear, right? You're just mindful, just aware. You don't actually turn off because that's almost like an active. So try these kind of things. Of course, if they may not, this always may not work, try to have a guided meditation. Yeah, use that, like you have a voice, something which maybe distracts you a little bit from the pain. Maybe even in this kind of case, maybe you can use some of this Zen music that sometimes you see advertised for meditation because it actually helps you to focus in a different place. Be creative about this because dealing with pain is actually very difficult. So be creative in what you do to lead your attention to a different place, a different area. One of the ways of dealing with pain is, of course, to focus on the pain in a particular place. And sometimes when you focus on it directly, it can certainly just evaporate. But if you have lots of pain in the body in many places, that may not be so easy. So, and ultimately, if your mind becomes incredibly peaceful, if you have some success with listening to some Zen music or whatever, maybe then you're able to transition onto the breath, yeah? Because actually you are feeling very peaceful. Maybe some joy arises. And once you get to that point, it may be that the pain in the body disappears completely and it won't be an issue anymore. So be creative. Don't be afraid of doing things that other people say is wrong. Very often you were told things are wrong, but really everything is contextual. Nothing is absolutely wrong. It really depends on the context and all kinds of things. That's why I say to people, when you come back home, you feel a bit stressed, put on some nice music, yeah? Don't put on heavy metal music, yeah? What was that?
It's calming.
It's right? So there you are. So nothing is perfectly true, right? It depends on who you are, right? It depends on your background. If you're grown up heavy metal, it probably really makes you really chill, right? So yeah, so that's a good point. For Zach, different rules apply to Zach. That's funny. Okay, so let's go on to the next one. Why do some monasteries focus more on work as meditation, less on study? it depends on. It depends a lot on the monastery here, and it depends a lot on. I think one of the ideal ways is for a monastery to be flexible, because just like lay people are on all different places on the path, the same is true for monastics. Yeah, some monastics are really well developed, they enjoy meditation profoundly. Others are really restless and they can't get their act together. They need something else. Yeah? That's life for you, life in a nutshell. Monasteries are like everywhere else. But that doesn't mean that they shouldn't be encouraged. Yeah, if you are a monastic, even if your mind isn't super peaceful or whatever, the fact that you have the intention to ordain is to be honored. It's so wonderful that people want to give their life to something so beautiful. And so always I would say, well, that means do something else. Work. So work, if you are a monastic, means charitable work. All the work we do is charitable. We don't get any money for it. So actually it's a powerful way of being generous. And so the idea is that if you do work, well, at the very least, you're building up other aspects of the path, like generosity and kindness and these kind of things. Yeah. So this is kind of the idea behind working in a monastery here. You're doing good actions, leading eventually to, hopefully, to meditation, all these kind of things. As long as you don't get too attached to that work, and work becomes everything, and you're kind of escaping reality through work, then it can be maybe not so useful. But still, it's a good thing to work in a monastery. One of the great things about being, I've been saying so many things that are great about being monastic, but one of the great things is that everything we do is for charity. Don't do anything. We don't get any salary, nothing like that. And this is the best way to work just because it is good, because it is kind, because you're doing the right thing, right? This is the best way to work, because there's no transaction there. I don't care, you know, what you do. I don't even care if you like my talks, to be honest. If you don't like my talks, fine, you know. As long as I enjoy it, that's what matters to me. So I remember Ajahn Brahm always gave this nice kind of advice. When you give a talk, just enjoy yourself. And I thought, yeah, that's a good advice. So, okay, just enjoy yourself. This is such a beautiful way of living. Everything you do is an act of generosity and kindness. It's far better than the transactional kind of living that we normally have. So this is why work in monasteries, right? And some monasteries have much more work. They focus more on that side of things. And this will often depend on the senior monks in that monastery. Yeah, how they think, because monasteries tend to be hierarchical. So if the abbot, especially in some Asian countries, because Asian societies are often hierarchical, that kind of feeds into the monasteries. And so then the abbot is the kind of the god in that monastery, right? He's the king, he decides everything, and no one says anything here. But in our monastery in Perth, it's much more democratic. So people are allowed to, you know, if they don't like what Ajahn Brahm says, that's fine, they're allowed to say so. And it's not really an issue. And often we have democratic decision-making rather than kind of hierarchical decision-making. That's actually very nice. I think it leads to more harmony in the long run, especially in a Western context. So I hope that you're okay with that. Do you have any advice on how to express your commitment to the spiritual path practice to your partner, to your children? Is it somehow selfish to pursue this inward life when you have been the giver? No, it is never selfish to pursue the inward life. Pursuing the inward life is always a gift to everyone around you, because that is how you become wise. That is how you become peaceful. This is how you develop good qualities. And the world will benefit from anyone who develops good qualities and wisdom and peace and all of these kind of things. The Buddha would not have existed in the world unless he left behind his wife and child and family and everything. We wouldn't have the Buddha in the world. So overall, I say it was a very good idea that the Buddha went forth and left everything behind. And then he bequeathed all his wisdom to the world as a consequence. That's a wonderful thing. So how do you express your commitment to the spiritual path practice to your partner? You express it through your actions, through your how you deal with them, how you treat them. You become a more contented, happy person in your family, basically, people start to feel that you have changed as a consequence of your commitment to the spiritual path. That is the best way to express it. You don't have to say anything very much at all. They have to, if they ask you where you're going, oh, I'm just going down to Barrie. Yeah, I don't know where you're from, but let's say you don't live in Barrie. So, yeah, I'm just going off to Barrie to, you know, chill a little bit. And they say, oh, yeah, please go to chill a little bit in Barrie. Yeah. And they're probably okay with that. And if you come back as a better person afterwards, then they will probably be very happy with you. Yeah, and they'll say, wow, Barrie, that's a transforming place. Please go to Barrie again. Yeah, we want more of this. Can we come along next time maybe or whatever? I don't know. So just do the right thing. And if there is an opportunity to discuss these matters, if they are interested in what you're doing, if they have an interest in Buddhism or spiritual life or whatever, of course, then you can discuss it. Yeah. Or as I mentioned before, you can leave a book around the house and maybe they kind of, who ordered this truckload of dung? It sounds like an interesting book anyway, right? Who wouldn't want to read that? That's kind of that's kind of an obvious one to read. So if that's lying around, everyone would probably grab it straight away. So, so gentle ways like this, and somehow it tends to work out. Somehow there will be interest after a while, or maybe they won't. It's very hard to say. It depends on, you know, what your family members are like. I don't know what they're like. But sometimes people will then take an interest, and they will gradually come around to these things. So in a sense, if you have always been the giver, then what that means is that now you become the super-duper giver. So you go from giver to kind of a super giver. So that's kind of nice, right? You become even better at giving in a certain way. Maybe you give differently. And maybe it comes out in a through kindness, through more how you are than what you do. If they ask what's going on, maybe you can make that point to them. Yeah, say, oh, I'm actually trying to be even more kind. I'm just doing it in a different way or whatever. That's all right. So find your way through this and gradually it will be, I think, very, very positive for your family if you do this. I was very pleased to see the positive impact it had on my family. I was really surprised to see that. And it was very kind of rewarding. When I was in Norway recently, I was teaching just a weekend retreat in Norway, teaching in Norwegian, which is really hard for me because my Norwegian Dhamma vocabulary is exactly zero. So it's very hard. So I kind of stumble on to use English words all the time. And in Norway, that's not such a big problem because everyone speaks English pretty well. But to my retreat, my brother came to my retreat. His son, my nephew, he came on the retreat, and that's really nice. My brother is so happy that I'm a monk. He thinks it's the greatest thing that ever happened. You know, because everyone else in the world, they don't know what they're doing. So good on you for being a monk. Yeah, and so it has a, when we live this life well, it actually has an effect on the people around us. So please carry on with that and see what happens in the long run. All right. Dear Ajahn, a fun Ajahn Brahm joke, why don't ants get COVID? Because they have little antibodies. All right, so this is a very typical, some of his jokes are even more fun than this one, I have to admit, but it's a kind of nice, it's one of those cute Ajahn Brahm jokes, so, all right. Okay, so what about good thoughts that come up in meditation, Dhamma reflections, right view, how do we approach these? The idea, remember, when we talk about when we think about good thoughts and meditation, we have to remember the purpose. Once we understand the purpose, then we will know whether it's appropriate or not. So the purpose is to become calm. The purpose is to become joyful. These are the two kind of main characteristics of deep and good meditation. So what do your Dhamma reflections lead to? That is the question you should ask. And in the suttas, they talk about the Dhammanusati, which is the recollection of Dhamma, right? So they talk about this idea of recalling the Dhamma, which can mean recalling the teachings. It can also mean recalling the Dhamma as a whole, what the teachings are about, or a specific teaching that you remember. But the purpose in recalling the Dhamma is always to give rise to joy. It's like, wow, this Dhamma, wow, it's so powerful. I feel so happy to have this teaching or something like that. Yeah, and it gives joy inside. That is what it should give rise to. Then it is working in the appropriate way. And it should also be a kind of thing that you will, yeah, you want to recall the Dhamma. A lot of the time, our mind is kind of just going on empty, yeah, it's kind of just kind of going and running by itself. You're not really directing it, and you think, is this a good thought or a bad thought? Well, the point is that you should be in charge of your mind. So if you want to think on Dhamma, well, then you think on Dhamma. But if you don't want to think on Dhamma, you don't think on Dhamma. If the mind kind of does it by itself and kind of just running around, then it's not such a good idea. This is what it means to be in charge of your thinking mind. You think exactly what you want to think. We saw that in the other sutta just the other day here. So this is how you decide what is good and what is useful here. Sometimes you decide, now I'm just going to contemplate the Dhamma. Then it's a bit different. Then if you actually make that decision, and I would recommend that you do that during walking meditation rather than sitting. Yeah, because it's easy to contemplate when the body is moving, the mind also kind of moves. And then you can take up a theme like, you know, what does impermanence mean to me? How does it affect my life? Yeah, and you kind of reflect about impermanence or maybe suffering, or you reflect on maybe the sequence of meditation steps, how does that work for me, or maybe you do a death contemplation or whatever. And you can do that as you do the walking meditation. Then you are deliberately doing that. And then you're not necessarily expecting joy because you are just trying to understand the Dhamma more deeply and how it affects your life and how it relates to your life. All right. Two questions to go here. Okay. Ajahn Brahmali, who, what is reborn? Isn't the personality too conditioned by its unique time, place, circumstances to carry over to the vastly different contexts? Yes, that is exactly right. Personality is conditioned by its unique time, place, circumstances to carry over to vastly different contexts. So, who, what is reborn? What is reborn is a stream of consciousness, yeah? There's still a little bit of heat there, Rebecca, so you're okay. You can relax. So it is a stream of consciousness that carries on from one life to the next one. And the stream of consciousness is itself a changing process, right? It's changing in this life, and then it changes as you go along from one life to the next one. That's kind of what is reborn. Yeah, movement of the stream of consciousness. Of course, the personality we have in this life will be, as I think maybe that's the point you're making here, will be conditioned by our external environment, right? We belong to an environment, we react to the environment, and our personality will be conditioned by that. Our place in society, who we take as our friends, whether we are a Buddhist or an atheist or a Christian or whatever, all of these things will condition our personality. And so you're quite right, if you then get reborn, and you get reborn in a different realm that is vastly different from now, or a different family, you will be conditioned by that realm. And you will kind of feel different, you know, suddenly you have a deva body, right? Oh, I have a deva body now, wow, this is nice. So you become a ghost or whatever, yeah, and you are different. But it will still feel like you are still there, right? This is still me, except that, you know, you have some additional attributes. It's like in this life, if you start out your life as poor and then you kind of build up a certain fortune and you die, you're quite well off. Well, you are a different person because the externals have changed. You're no longer the same person as when you were born into this life. In the same way, change is happening. In the same way, change will happen from one life to the next one when you are, you know, whatever it is that you get reborn into. Of course, if you get reborn as an animal, it's going to be quite different because there you get reborn into a very different kind of body and very different kind of experience. So there it may be quite hard to recognize yourself as an animal because it's just that life is so different as an animal. But as a spiritual being, like a deva, I think it should be no problem in seeing the continuation because it's a natural continuation. As a ghost, maybe also you recognize the continuation. Is that what you're asking about? Yes, please.
So, what is stream of consciousness?
That's what you're experiencing now. Mm-hmm. Yeah? Now, right now, you experience the stream of consciousness. It's just the mind flowing on, always changing. Yeah, you see something else. You feel good, you feel not so good. You think one thing, you think something else. You perceive something. You have a will and you have another will. You choose something, you choose something else. Continuous flow of the mind. This is the stream of consciousness. You could call it the stream of the mind if you like. Yeah, and always moving, changing. And that flows on into the next existence. Yeah. All right, last question. Ajahn Brahmali, please speak more about how to recognize samadhi and the four jhanas if one should achieve it. Aids to progressing. Thank you. How to recognize the four jhanas? Well, if you ever have a jhana experience, you will know something extreme happened to you. You will know, I don't know what this is, but wow, this is the meaning of life or something like that. You've kind of really, you will have, I think I mentioned it before, you have like this positive trauma effect on you. You will never, ever forget it for the rest of your life. Yeah, it is a very powerful experience. So that is one way, you know, you have kind of achieved something exceptional. But if you want to follow how these things are described in the suttas, then you will know that they're... You will know that there is no more experience of the five senses. The five senses have completely disappeared. In fact, they are so disappeared, you don't have access to them anymore. The mind is completely stilled. There's no feeling that you can actually will anything or do anything with the mind. Yeah, there is in the first jhana, there's a little bit of movement, but it's not as if you are doing it. It's just happening to you. You are just the experiencer, the passenger in that case. So no real will, no real five senses. Most powerful bliss you have ever experienced in your life, to the point where you wonder whether you're able to deal with it. It's like, actually, you don't even wonder that because you can't think, right? So it's actually no, you don't wonder. It's just as you, maybe as you go in, you might wonder about that. It is, there's no thinking there. Obviously, if the mind can't move, there's no will, there's no thinking in those states. The mind is completely stilled. Yeah. So this gives you a rough idea what these things are. They're called Uttari Madhusudama, superhuman, or states beyond the human capacities, or insights and knowledge, worthy of the noble ones, and these kind of things. They're very, very elevated states. But there's a lot of happiness on the path before you get to the jhanas and deep samadhis. Yeah? And this is kind of the beauty of this path. There's a kind of the joys and things at the very beginning, the gladness that you get just from living well, doing the right thing. Yeah? And then you build it up stage by stage. Yeah? Gladness, then the joy, then the tranquility, then the bliss, then the samadhi. Yeah? Each one building on the previous one. One happiness greater than the previous one. Yeah? So it's really kind of this wonderful thing, right? And like, in a sense, the more kind of unreal the jhana is, the more powerful it is, the more far away it is, the more kind of interesting it is, because you have to go through all these hoops, go through all these steps before you get there. It's like this literally entering another world when you get to the jhanas. So very, very fascinating. So this is how you basically recognize it. But, you know, it might be a good idea to go to a experienced jhana meditator when if you have something like this and ask them what happened, and they might be able to help you out. Ajahn Brahm, probably the best one. He's one of the most experienced jhana meditators probably anywhere. So he's a great person to ask. Are you happy with that answer? Or would you like to come back on it or say anything else? So that was the last question. You haven't asked enough questions. Please, don't.
Yeah. When you die, you still have the five senses.
Yeah, yeah. Unless you enter jhana as you die, yeah.
Mm. But that's not the case for most people. So they still have a sense of touch?
When you die? Or jhana?
No, like as a ghost, basically.
As a ghost, right, okay, as a ghost, yeah. Well, this is the interesting thing, not only touch, but all the five senses as a ghost, right? So this is kind of the interesting thing about the body. The body, you kind of draw one body out of the other one. There's a subtle body drawn out of the gross, coarse, physical body, and that subtle body has the five senses, just like the coarse body. That's kind of interesting. It actually specifically says that in the suttas. It's hinindriya. Hinindriya means, no, ahinindriya. It is not deficient in any faculties. Yeah. So it is almost as if the body has all these subtle aspects and the senses kind of go with those aspects. So you don't need the kind of the coarse physical eye. You can have a more refined eye that sees just as well as this eye here. Yeah, that's kind of the weird thing. So, yeah. Does that make sense? I can't see much reaction back there, but
we'll see.
We'll see. Okay, we'll see. We'll see when you die. Yeah. So yeah, but this is what you hear when you hear about these near-death experiences. Yeah, you hear about people coming out of the body. They still see. They still hear. They know everything that's going on. That's the weird thing, right? That is. And once you hear people say these things, I find it very hard to dismiss people's, stories. Why wouldn't they be real? There seems to be very good reason to think that they're real. I tend to believe people unless I have very good reason to the contrary, for to really think they're lying or whatever, or deluded or whatever. Maybe I'm just gullible, but I tend to have I trust people a lot unless I have a good reason to think otherwise, and usually that trust kind of pays off. Anyone else would like to say anything? Yeah. This is your last chance. Yeah, please. Please.
How big are the retreats at John Grove? How many people?
There's 60 people on the retreats. I will tell you, that's all you need, but I'll give you more anyway, even that's all you need. So it's 60, because there are 60 rooms. Okay. So I don't know how you sleep here. How do you sleep here?
Singles?
Okay, that's great. So in Jhana Grove, everyone gets a single room and your own bathroom, right? So that's a lot of seclusion, right? Yeah, that's a lot of seclusion. And then we have a Dhamma hall that is enormous. I mean, it makes this hall here look like a kind of a Mickey Mouse hall. No, it's a different one. Yeah, it's not as nice. I must admit, it doesn't have as nice an atmosphere as this one, because this one has kind of nice woodwork and all these kind of things. But you close your eyes anyway, so it doesn't matter all that much. So enormous Dhamma hall, and you have walking meditation rooms connected to that Dhamma hall all the way around. It's a large property, so kind of nice gardens and things, and you can walk into the bush and check out the kangaroos and that kind of thing, and see what you think of the kangaroos.
I hope to make it in 2000.
Yeah, okay, yeah, wonderful. I hope to see you there, yeah, that'd be marvelous. Are you going to come with Venerable Santu Sikha, or?
Oh, I don't know if she's going.
Okay, she's going for the rains this year. She's coming, yeah, she's coming this year for the rains.
Yeah,
so that would be great, yeah. Yeah.
YouTube.
Yeah, I think she will be very capable. She's very she will do a really good job. I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Anyone else? Please. Yeah.
Does Ajahn Pasapanya ever tour?
She does travel a little bit. She does travel to mostly Southeast Asia, Singapore, Malaysia, those kind of places. If you invited her, she might come here. So it's really up to you. I have you heard her talks?
Or?
Yeah. Okay. Good. Yeah. Yeah. She has this bubbly, energetic kind of character. I know. So I must admit, I really respect her. I think she's quite, in many ways, quite a good meditator. Has many, 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 many good qualities actually. Yeah. So Who was first?
Whoever else.
Okay, please. Yeah.
I have a question about ghosts. My little cousin saw my grandmother apparently in a mirror once when she was very young. And I was just wondering whether you think that means she's stuck, like, or because you get reborn as a ghost.
Yeah.
But then, like, is it possible to just show up in a moment and then, or does it either usually means they're stuck there?
don't know. I think there are many ways in which beings from all kinds of realms can show themselves in our realms. It's very hard to know exactly what's going on. But it could mean that. It's possible. In any case, it is always good to make some good karma for the people who passed away. So make some merit for her. And tell, was it your grandma or was it, yeah? So tell your grandma, I'm doing this for you. Yeah, mm-hmm. That's kind of sweet, right? Because imagine that she is there and she sees you doing this, yeah, and you're doing it for her. It's actually very nice to make that connection with some of your, you know, old relatives in that way. Yeah? So, And I think this is kind of one of the power, strong sides of Buddhism. We know how to deal with people who passed away, and we know how to deal with death in a reasonably good way. And we kind of help people. They often say, no, that the welfare state goes from the birth to the grave, right? But in Buddhism, we take it beyond the grave. Buddhist welfare goes kind of into the ghost realm as well. So, yeah, do something good for her and see what happens. Maybe that would be a beautiful thing to do, yeah.
Yeah, my question has to do with stuckness as well. Like, if you're withdrawn from the senses in jhana, can you lose sense of time and ruin your body because you're in it for too long? Or
absolutely lose sense of time. Right? You must be dead. You have no sense of time at all. The sense of time is completely gone, and you have no idea. And you come out 5 hours later and you think, "Wow, what happened?" And so jhana is exactly one of the characteristics of jhana. No sense of time. I should maybe mention that. Can you ruin your body? No. When you come out of a jhana state, the body is the most relaxed it's ever been. It's completely at ease, regardless of how long you sit. That's the weird thing about it, right? That's kind of the weird thing. You sit for 7 days, you come out, your body is completely at ease. So that shows you that there is a lot of things going on that are not normal, right? There's something abnormal going on. The mind has a very powerful effect on the physical body in that sense. So that's kind of exciting, interesting. Yeah. Please, yeah.
So I thought that one of the things you were supposed to master for the jhana was like being able to go in and come out at will, and yet I'm having trouble reconciling that with, so you're in jhana for 5 hours, and, you know. So how do you reconcile
that? You make a determination beforehand how long you're going to be in there. So you come out exactly at 2 hours, 23 minutes, 45 seconds. Bang, you're out. So that's how that's basically how it works. It's like sometimes, you know, sometimes you go to sleep and you kind of determine when to wake up, and sometimes you wake up exactly at the right time. And it's kind of weird how the mind has that ability. And when it comes to the jhana state, that ability is enhanced a lot. So you come out exactly when you want to come out.
Even though you're not tracking.
Even though not tracking. Just like you wake up at night, you're not really tracking the time at night either. You just wake up at the right time. Yeah, same kind of thing. It's like a program which is kind of running in the background that you're not aware of. And when the time is ready, it just kind of wakes you up. Brings you out. Okay, maybe it's time to call it a day. So let's do the Arahang Samma Sambuddho. Would you mind, David, to turn on the projector again, please? That will then. Okay.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.